Palestinian journalist Mariam Barghouti. She's a senior Palestine correspondent for Mondo Weiss. She usually is based in Ramallah, but is joining us from New York City today. It's great to have you with us, Mariam. If you can talk about the escalating violence right now in the West Bank.
Thank you. It's good to be here again, Amy. Thank you for having me. Right now, what we're seeing is an intensification of Israeli settler violence against Palestinians in the collective. So it's not just being intensified at the level of attacks towards Palestinians, but it's increasing in size. And this is reminiscent of what we have seen in 2021 when Israeli settlers rampaged through the old city of Jerusalem, as well as cities in heartland Palestine, such as Yaffa, Tel Aviv, Haifa, chanting death to Arabs. And that's what they have been doing now, is killing Arabs. We've had almost 700 Palestinians killed since those chants began in 2021. And right now what we are seeing is a joining of forces once again between Israeli settlers in uniform, such as the army and border police, and Israeli settlers in civilian clothing, but also armed, attacking Palestinians under the false manipulated discourse that this is a response to a Palestinian militant operation. This is not a response to that. This is the status quo. This is the daily norm. We saw it happen in 2015 when an entire Palestinian family in Nablus, near the location where the most recent arson attack happened en masse, an entire family was burned in Douma, including an infant just a few months old and his mother and father, leaving the last remaining child in the family, who was three at the time, orphaned. So what we're seeing is an intensification to completely take over Palestine. And it's not just Palestine in the sense of the West Bank. This is Gaza. This is heartland Palestine in Jerusalem. And right now you're seeing attacks exactly the same way Israeli forces have attacked Palestinians in the West Bank, happening in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. So Israel is moving full force to do exactly what Bezalel Smotrich, the current finance minister of Israel, called for in terms of Hawara and Nablus. And that is wipe it out. What they are doing right now is wiping it out.
The U.S. State Department's Office of Palestinian Affairs said it was appalled by the attacks on Palestinians by the Israeli settlers, adding, "We call the Israeli authorities to immediately stop the violence, protect U.S. and Palestinian civilians, and prosecute those responsible." There are many also Palestinian Americans who are living there as well, right? Can you talk about the State Department's response? Did that surprise you?
It did not surprise me. The U.S. State Department has rarely interfered or intervened on behalf of Palestinian American citizens in order to push forward for justice. More than a year later, and the assassination of the Palestinian American journalist Shirin Abu Akleh last year, who was also killed by an Israeli sniper shot in Jenin, still did not receive accountability. And come the dozens of others that were killed who are American citizens and zero accountability, anyone that was arrested in the Israeli military, known for torturing and mistreating their political detainees, the U.S. did not interfere. I think that the words, the language that they try to push forward, as though they are truthfully and sincerely representing American citizenry, as they claim, is false. What we see is the U.S. arming Israel continuously and consistently. What we see is the U.S. vetoing any potentials or opportunity for actually holding Israel accountable. I have never heard of asking the butcher to be told to give themselves judgment and accountability. I have never heard of that dynamic, except in this.
During the raid in Jenin, Israel deployed U.S.-made Apache helicopter gunships for the first time inside the West Bank in nearly 20 years, and also carried out its first targeted assassination aerial strike in the West Bank for the first time in 20 years. They have done that in Gaza more recently. Can you talk about the significance of this and what difference it means when groups in the United States, particularly Jewish groups, put pressure on the U.S. government around the issue of weapons that the that Israel uses coming from the United States?
Thank you for asking that. It's really important to recognize that just recently, the current Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who was actually denied service in the Israeli military because he was considered a terrorist and a threat to national security, is now the Minister of National Security, has called for a renewed military operation called Defensive Shield. Now, Defensive Shield was a military operation in the early 2000s, between 2002-2003, that took place mostly between Jenin, Nablus, Beit Lahem, and Ramallah in the West Bank. And they blew up homes wall to wall. That is how they moved through cities. And it was considered to be one of the most destructive and tragic military operations to have hit Palestinians in the West Bank. And Israel is being, it was investigated, and it has shown the evidence that Israel has committed crimes against humanity and war crimes during these operations. A few months ago, Itamar Ben-Gvir called for Operation Defensive Shield 2.0, basically. So that's the significance of using that drone for the first time in 20 years, because the last time it was used was 2006, where they targeted the young fighters at the time. And now those born in 2000, 2002, 3, 4, 5, at the peak of Operation Defensive Shield, have grown up, and they have seen no change, and they tried to confront back. And now Ben-Gvir is asking to kill those, the children that grew up under nothing but war, who are mostly refugees on World Refugee Day. Almost 80% of those killed in the last 2 years were refugees in their refugee camps.
Israeli settlers rampaged through Palestinian towns in the West Bank Wednesday, killing at least one person, critically injuring another, torching buildings and cars. This is a resident of the town of Termasaya.
Dozens of settlers came here, around 200, 250 settlers. They tried to enter the courtyard. They set the cars on fire. They started shooting towards the house, using live bullets and stones, and they damaged the balconies. There were almost 14 family members at home, including women and children. But thank God there were no injuries. They tried to open the doors, but they were closed.
Mariam, if you can talk more about what the Israeli government, how the Israeli government responds to Israeli settlers rampaging.
So the Israeli government arms and provides protection to Israeli settlers rampaging. They send in military forces with the settlers in civilian clothing, who are armed as well, in order to facilitate ease of movement across Palestinian towns and villages. What happened in Termasaya was preceded in a similar occurrence just a few months ago, and it was preceded by a mass arson attack in Hawara near Nablus also a few months ago. So this is not an anomaly. It's not the exception. It's the norm. And this is why it is important for especially Jewish voices in the U.S. to continue tackling this issue where their name and their beliefs is being used to perpetuate crimes against humanity, and to also benefit the weapons trade industry. It's not just the U.S. providing weapons to Israel. It is the U.S. and Israel tag-teaming to test those weapons on Palestinians. They have turned the Palestinian demographic into lab rats.
I want to end with Mohammed Al-Tamimi, the two-year-old Palestinian child who was recently shot dead by Israeli soldiers. You have written about this and the personal effect it has on you covering this kind of brutality. Tell us about him.
Mohammed Al-Tamimi was a two-year-old boy who was killed as Israeli soldiers chased other Palestinian youth firing bullets at the car near the village of Nabi Saleh in Ramallah. Muhammad was next to his father when the shooting happened. And as we know, as I have seen from testimonies and documentation, Israel does not discriminate, indeed, between child or adult. civilian or non-civilian, combatant or non-combatant. The father was injured. Muhammad, who is two, was killed. And you need to understand that his mother is this young woman who I've known when she was a child, who has helped protect adults from Israeli arrests, who grew up in Nabi Saleh watching one death after the other. This is a small village and could not protect her two-year-old son. I don't know what that does to a mother. I don't know what that does to a young mother. And I don't know what that does to a mother living under consistent trauma. That's what happened with Muhammad Tamimi, who is two. And that's what happens to dozens of Palestinian families. And it's not to discourage us, but it is to empower us and make us say, no, yeah, we refuse this dynamic and reality. Well, not at our tax dollars.
Mariam Barghouti, I want to thank you for being with us. Senior Palestine correspondent for Mondo Weiss, based in Ramallah, speaking to us, though, today from New York City. You mentioned the idea that Palestine is a lab. Coming up, we speak with the author Anthony Lowenstein about his new book, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World, back in 30 seconds. The Milkman of Human Kindness by Billy Bragg. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. That's the title of a new book by the Australian journalist Anthony Lowenstein, who examines how Israel's military-industrial complex has used the occupied Palestinian territories for decades, he says, as a testing ground for weaponry and surveillance technology that they then export around the world. Anthony Lowenstein is the author of a number of books, including Disaster Capitalism and My Israel Question. He was based in East Jerusalem between 2016 and 2020. His most recent article for the Sydney Morning Herald is Being Jewish and Critical of Israel Can Make You an Outcast, I Should Know. Anthony is joining us from Sydney, Australia. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Anthony. Your book has just come out. What do you mean by the term the Palestine Laboratory?
Thanks so much for having me on, Amy. What I mean by that is that the occupation of Palestine by Israel is now the longest occupation in modern times, 56 years and counting. There's obviously been an occupation of sorts since 1948, but particularly since 1967. And during those years, what Israel has done very successfully from its perspective is find various tools and technologies to maintain and control Palestinians. And what they've done during that time, what Israel's done, is increasingly export those tools and technologies, but also those methods, those so-called counterinsurgency methods. So what I look at in the book, both being on the ground in Palestine for many years and also through declassified documents and various interviews across the world, is that you find in over 130 countries across the globe in the last decades, Israel has sold forms of anything from spyware, so-called smart walls, facial recognition tools, a range of tools of occupation and repression that have initially been tested in Palestine on Palestinians. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that the occupation of Palestine is not staying there. It's not a conflict that remains geographically based just in Palestine. It's become so-called global Palestine.
How would you describe politicide, a term you use?
Politicide, I think, was a term that was coined by Burrell Kimmeling, who is now the late amazing academic. And he was talking really about the concept of a desire within many in the Israeli elite to find ways to destroy Palestinians. That not necessarily just through killing them, but also through extinguishing their political identity, their political self-determination. And when looking at it from the outside, one could argue that in some ways Palestinian resistance lives on. Your last segment talked about that very strongly. Palestinians mostly have not left Palestine. They remain there. But certainly from the current Israeli government, and I would argue for decades, there has been a sense that there's a way to crush Palestinian aspirations, their views, their political reality, their future, their horizon. And by doing so, Israel has increasingly marketed that to a global audience, including in its whole identity as an ethno-nationalist state. It's arguably the most successful ethno-nationalist state in the world, a Jewish supremacist state. And growing numbers of nations around the world, from India and others, look to Israel with admiration and inspiration.
We just covered Modi and the lavish reception he got by the president of the United States, Biden, with the state dinner last night, the joint session of Congress. Talk about a little more about how India looks to Israel.
Look, what India is doing under Modi, of course, is not solely because of Israel. But traditionally, Israel and India were not particularly good friends. But in the last 10 years or so, since Modi took power in 2014, there's been a real ideological alignment. But the relationship is really twofold. One, it's a defense relationship. So India buys huge amounts of technology, defense equipment, spyware. I interview a number of people in my book, individuals in India, lawyers, others, who are spied on by Israeli spyware, particularly Pegasus by NSO Group. But also there's an ideological alignment, a belief that many Indian officials in the Hindu fundamentalist government there are openly talking about admiration for what Israel's doing in the West Bank and wanting to do something similar in Kashmir. And what I mean by that is they say that two reasons. One, because Israel gets away with it, no one's stopping it. There's a complete state of impunity that Israel has globally, really. But secondly, this idea of bringing in, according to India's view, huge numbers of Hindus to Muslim-majority Kashmir to settle that territory, to build so-called settlements akin to what Israel's doing in the West Bank. And I think there's a really disturbing ideological alignment. I would actually make the comparison between Israel and India today to Israel and apartheid South Africa back in the day. Nations that were very, very close ideologically and got inspiration from each other in the belief, in Israel's case, of course, being a Jewish supremacist state, and India's case being increasingly a Hindu fundamentalist state. And that, to me, is something that should concern people, including the US president.
So, Anthony, you talk about a Jewish supremacist state. I'm wondering if you could talk about your own background, something that you take on in this last piece you wrote. Being Jewish and critical of Israel can make you an outcast, I should know. And talk about your family, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, those who died in Auschwitz, those who didn't survive the Holocaust.
Most of my family, sadly, Amy, like most Jews who lived in Europe, perished in the Holocaust, including Auschwitz. And the ones who got out and escaped Europe, particularly in 1939, just before the war started, escaped to wherever they were given a visa, Australia, Canada, the US, elsewhere. And the ones who came to Australia when I was growing up, I was born in the mid-70s in Melbourne. Israel was not the center of their lives, but Israel was seen as a safe haven. For those who don't know, as a Jew, I can go to Israel tomorrow, and within a few months, I can almost certainly be a Jewish citizen if I can prove that I'm Jewish. And I think for many Jews, including my family, there was a real reluctance and, in fact, a hostility to any kind of Palestinian reality, Palestinian story, even to meet Palestinians. I mean, as a young Jew, I never met Palestinians. And I think there is a change going on. But certainly when I started writing about this issue around 20 years ago, I wrote a book in 2006 called My Israel Question, where there were attempts by the Israel lobby in Australia to censor the book. There was attempts to pulp the book. There was condemnations of me in Parliament. I mean, it was ridiculous. The book became a bestseller, thanks to all that ridiculous controversy. But over that time, my parents, both of whom lost most of their Jewish friends because it was the sins of the son. I was being critical of Israel. I was trying to humanize Palestinians. Now, I'm not the only Jew, of course, who was saying this. And I'm really encouraged in the last years in Australia, the US and other Western countries are growing almost like a Jewish insurgency against particularly an older generation of Jews who doesn't want to humanize Palestinians and somehow believes that Jewish identity should be tied to Jewish supremacy. And so for me personally, I don't claim to be a victim. That story that you referenced at the beginning sort of gives a bit of a potted history of my life, but also explains that one does pay a price for it. One does pay a price as a Jewish person. I'm a secular anti-Zionist Jew today. But I feel often that there is a real moral collapse in much of the Jewish diaspora in the last decades. It is changing, but not nearly fast enough.
Anthony, we were talking about the horrific shipwreck last week of migrants, maybe up to 700 dead. Can you talk about Israeli technology used by the European Union to surveil and target asylum seekers?
This really shocked me, you know, years ago when I started doing some work on this issue. The short version is that the European Union in the last years after 2015, when they were, in their view, overwhelmed by particularly Muslim refugees from Syria, Afghanistan and elsewhere, didn't want to ever repeat that. And they put in place almost the fortress-type Europe, which has occurred in the last years, which is a range of tools and technologies to keep people out. Mostly Muslim and brown and black bodies, of course. And part of that arsenal is using Israeli drones. They're unarmed, but they are flying over the Mediterranean 24/7, and they're used mostly by Frontex, which is the EU's sort of border security arm. And they're the eyes in the sky, essentially. So they are sending back all these images 24/7 to Warsaw, which is where Frontex is based. And the EU has made a decision, of course they don't admit this, but this is the reality, of letting people drown. This is the new policy. There are very, very few rescue boats. The EU barely rescues anyone. There are some NGOs that are trying to do so, and I deeply admire what they're doing. So the Israeli drone becomes a key arsenal and part of this infrastructure of essentially allowing people to drown. And to me, it really goes to the heart of why Israeli drones are used by the EU, because they were battle-tested in Palestine over Gaza in a number of years in the last 15 years. And you see this almost Israeli border industrial complex exported across the US-Mexico border, for example. There are massive amounts of Israeli surveillance towers made by Elbit, which is Israel's leading defense company, dotted across the border. It's a key part of the US arsenal across its border with Mexico. And why was that company chosen by the US? Because, of course, it was tested first in Palestine. So to me, the real concern in the 21st century is as the climate crisis worsens, as resource wars are worsening, as refugee numbers have never been higher since World War II, many Western nations are sadly making a choice to not welcome people in, as we saw with the recent awful shipwreck or disaster in the Mediterranean, but in fact to build higher walls and more surveillance. And Israeli surveillance and technology and repression is part of that arsenal that many nations are now buying because it's been used, in their view, successfully on Palestinians in Palestine.
And do you have evidence of the United States in particularly controversial situations working with Israel to perhaps have, for example, in Guatemala, work there so that the United States won't get won't be held responsible?
Absolutely. One of the things I document in the book really clearly is that over the last 50 years, a lot of nations that the US was close to, Israel almost became an American wingman, often supporting, arming, training nations the US even couldn't do officially because of some issue maybe in Congress. And that did include nations like Guatemala, including at a point where they were committing genocide against their indigenous populations. And one of the reasons that many of those nations, Guatemala, Honduras, Chile under Pinochet, a range of other nations in Latin and South America, although of course it went far further, including in Africa and Asia, was that these nations were really attracted by the idea of learning the so-called skills that Israel was gaining through its occupation after 1967. How is it managing the Palestinian population? How is it repressing them, essentially? And there's huge amounts of evidence through declassified documents and interviews, much of which is in the book, which really goes to the heart of showing that the US and Israel became almost like invaluable partners during that period, to the point where today, look, America remains the world's biggest arms dealer. 40% of the world's arms is sold by the US. Israel is now 10th. And just last week, in fact, Israel released its 2022 arms figures, 12.5 billion US, the biggest amount ever, and 25% of that was going to Arab autocracies after the so-called Abraham Accords, the Trump deal from a few years ago. So we're talking about Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and others. So what are they selling? They're selling repressive technology, spyware, intelligence gathering, a range of other tools to prop up US and Israeli-backed dictatorships in the Middle East. So this is what the Israeli arms industry is about. Like, this to me is a not just a moral failing, but a really dark stain on the Jewish legacy 75 years after the Holocaust. Like, this is what we've become. We, meaning the Jewish population of the world, the legacy seems to be backing and supporting and arming the worst regimes in the world.
Let me ask you about something you mentioned earlier, and that's NSO's Pegasus. Explain further how it's used and how it is used to infect the phones, for example, of journalists, some, for example, who are in jail, like in Morocco, as you talk about the Abraham Accords, Omar Adi, who we interviewed before he was imprisoned and has been now for several years.
Pegasus got a lot of attention in the last years, as viewers will know, as probably the most known or infamous Israeli spyware. Essentially, it's a tool that allows any government or military intelligence or police department to spy on someone's phone, iPhone or Android, and get all the information from that phone. And it's popped up in dozens and dozens of countries around the world. And I spend a lot of time in the book interviewing some of the victims of that surveillance in Togo, for example, in Mexico, in India. And Mexico, interestingly enough, is the biggest user of Pegasus by far. There is an absolute addiction in Mexico, both under right-wing governments and the current nominally left-wing government. Governments don't want to give this tool up. And it's not just Pegasus. Of course, there are many other Israeli companies doing the same thing. But one of the things that I exploring the book is that so much of the media in the last years around Pegasus missed the key point. It was almost framed as a rogue Israeli company doing terrible things around the world. But in fact, companies like Pegasus actually are only private in name. They are basically arms of the state. Netanyahu and the Mossad, who have been going to various countries in the last 10 years, document this in the book, and this has also been shown by Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, often go to nations like Saudi Arabia, Rwanda, and others, and they hold Pegasus and other tools as a diplomatic carrot. If you support us in the UN or elsewhere, we will sell you the most powerful spyware in the world. And it works because it's been sold in UAE and Saudi and Rwanda and many other repressive states. So unless there is a complete ban or massive regulation, which currently does not exist at all, these technologies will continue. And even if NSO Group disappears tomorrow and it's currently in financial crisis, many other companies do exactly the same thing, and which is why Israel is now one of the leading spyware exporters in the world.
Well, Anthony Lowenstein, I want to thank you so much for being with us, author of the new book, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. If you want to see our interview with the now imprisoned Moroccan journalist Omar Adi, as well as our other work talking to the University of Toronto Lab and others about Pegasus, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes. As well, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Tune in on July 4th from 8 to 10 p.m. for Sounds of the Sun Volume 1, a summer solstice sound project by Unit Pit. Curators Catherine DeMontre and Marissa Cranglot Holmes will be your hosts, featuring an eclectic mix of soundworks by 10 artists. Sounds of the Sun reflect on the solar movement through music, field recordings, storytelling, and experimental audio works. Sounds of the Sun Volume 1 beckons the promise of beach days, AC on max, forest fires, and an excess of sun worship. To learn more, visit unitpit.ca. That's unitpott.ca.
You are listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.